This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
My name is Raya Zain. I would like to begin by acknowledging that the land that we're on right now is the unceded and therefore occupied territory of the Lenape people. So a little bit of background of how we came here into this space. The organizing for these events started about a year ago. And over this period, these 13 scholars who research questions of geopolitics and popular culture, of digital sovereignty, and the theory and history of global media in the Middle East, in Africa, in Asia, and the Americas, we work to identify common themes in our interests and shared questions that resonate between our research sites. The result was the call for papers under the theme Popular Culture and Coloniality, Decolonizing Global Media Studies. We received dozens of compelling research proposals from all over the world and selected 16 pieces of original research, 13 of which we will hear tomorrow. As the fellows deliberated the content and the shape of the conference tomorrow, we were eager to start our conversations on what coloniality is and how it remains with us as scholars of global media and communication and culture, with attention to the practice of decolonization. Would this be different from a theory of decolonizing or a critique of colonialism? In what ways? So tonight, we are excited to be hosting what we think will be a productive conversation bridging different activist, artist, academic and cultural perspectives. So we're very pleased and honored to have the four of you here with us today. So how the rest of the evening is going to go is like this. The 13 fellows have put together 5 general discussion questions. We're going to put these to the panelists. This discussion will last about an hour, and then we'll open the floor to Q&A from you. When this is over, we will formally conclude the discussion, but we will informally continue over refreshments in the other room. So please stick around. So I have the first question. We would like to ask, what has it meant and what does it mean to you to decolonize? What are your strategies for practicing decolonization?
I begin from a very material place, and I think about kind of in a post-World War II context, what it means to have, or in a pre-World War II context, somewhere during the interwar period, we have all these nation states or all these spaces that are still very much under colonial rule, very much under colonial rule. I mean, up until World War II, 750 million people are still under colonial rule. And when we think about decolonization, first, it's the kind of material practice of colonial withdrawal. And that takes more than a notion to do that, right? That's not a small thing. But when I think about decolonization beyond that, I think about all of the work that needs to happen to evict colonial power from our minds, from our spirits, from our cultural practices, from our rituals, from our ways of understanding the world. And that is a much more, I won't call it intractable because we will win, but it's a much more challenging project. And that's the work that we're constantly doing, the work of unlearning a way of understanding the world that is so deeply ingrained into our way of being that we don't see it as a particular choice, right, but as simply how the world is, a doxa, as Bourdieu would say. And when we enter into that space, I think in terms of my own work, it means, I think the first thing that has to happen for me is the space of self-critique, the space of asking at all times, who am I in this space, and in what ways am I replicating or reinforcing, doubling down even, on the kind of colonial presence and the colonial project? As activists and organizers, our first thing to do is to project out. I remember when I first moved to Brooklyn, I kept complaining about gentrifiers. And finally, I was in a barbershop complaining about gentrifiers. They were like, yo, dude, you live in a high rise. You're not from here. You're a professor. You're on TV. I'm pretty sure you make more than everybody in this shop. You're a gentrifier. You know, understand. And it was like this, like, I was like unsettled for the rest of the day. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to go. You know, I didn't want to go to the juice bar, you know, in the spa. I was uneasy but there came this moment where I had to figure out what that meant and how I could either redress that or reconcile it or do something with that tension. And I think as an academic and as an intellectual, it's very much important for me to do that, to ask how can I occupy these spaces in ways that are resistant, almost in the Saidian model of being in exile. How can I occupy a space of exile within this context? And for me, that's the first space of decolonization for me.
Shiks Pakwe, Winikshash Felicia, Washnash Yakima Kinik Kublakinik, Nishak Chasanabe Hokumpa, Ku Yakima Nation. Good evening, my name is Felicia Teeter, Penimpt, she, her pronouns. I live in Lenape Hoking, as I said, and I'm from the Yakima Nation in so-called Washington State. And for me, decolonizing looks like a lot of things. The most immediate decolonization looks like learning my language and bringing those to spaces. It means learning my culture and bringing that to spaces. It means learning our food and bringing that to spaces. It means learning our ceremonies or our ways of life and our ways of being and talking about those and bringing those to these spaces. Understanding that these spaces aren't meant for me, nor are they meant for me to bring that knowledge into them. Decolonizing looks like waking up every day. There are people who don't get to because colonization leads them to murder themselves. It leads them to murder their spirits, and it leads them to murder their minds. I have the opportunity to wake up every day, and that is decolonizing in and of itself because Indigenous people are not made to be here. We are not made to be alive on this continent, nor are we made to be alive on any continent that is currently under colonial rule, because colonial rule and settler colonialism requires that we are dead, either physically or at least in your minds. So that's what decolonizing looks like when I'm home, in my homelands. I'm not in my homelands right now. So decolonizing looks different for me here than it does on the land of my ancestors. Here, decolonizing looks like taking another step and learning about the people here. Acknowledging the land is great. Talking to the people who are of this land is better and it's important, and that's what decolonizing actually looks like, is going and talking to the Lenni Lenapes of Delaware. It's talking to the Ramapo Lenapes. It's talking to the Delaware tribe of Indians. It's talking to the Lenape who are currently displaced in Oklahoma. It's finding the Lenape who are currently displaced in so-called Canada. And it's bringing those voices into this space. And it's intentionally bringing them into the space and then ceding the space to them. So in that sense, me sitting on this panel is an act of colonization because this is not my space. I am Latin Lenape, this is not my land. Unfortunately, we didn't have enough time to have Lenape come out because the closest Lenapes to us are an hour and a half away is their cultural center. And so recognizing that, knowing that Lenapes are not people who were here and are no longer, that there are a lot of Lenapes living among you, and if you don't know how to find them, looking for them, that is something that I had to do as an Indigenous person coming to this space. I had to go out and intentionally look for Lenape people and the people of this land, and I do that when I go into any other space, intentionally look for those people and talk to those people and learn about that land. And you don't even necessarily have to, like, you will learn about their struggle because that's just, it's part of who we are as Indigenous folks. It's part of anyone when you get to know them, is learning about their struggle and learning about the things that they have gone through and the ways that they continue to be resistant and resilient. But also learning about their medicines, learning about why this place is called this thing, learning about how they use that tree, or learning about how this tree is an invasive species. I just came back from Somisek, which is unceded Estak Gano land in so-called Texas. And I was able to spend time with the chairman there. And he just walked me around and showed me how they used to use willows to create not only their sweat lodges, but also their homes. And he showed me these flowers that they used for tea. And he showed me his knowledge of the land because they have been there since time immemorial. And so really taking the time to learn about the people in the space that you are in, not just as theoretical ideas or things that live on the internet or as historical relics, but as people who are alive here and now, and as people who are continuing to survive settler colonialist rule in the here and now, and people who are continuing to fight against settler colonial rule in the here and now, because they are fighting. Everywhere that you go, their existence is resistance, and it is the fight. So actually taking the time to learn about them is a necessary part of decolonization.
I'm from Punjab in India, and I was born and brought up in India. And so my framework of decolonization comes from my grandparents' generation fighting the British Empire and kind of growing up with that. And then the work that, you know, we're doing currently with Decolonize This Place brings me to thinking about Decolonize This Place right now here in New York, but also thinking about decolonization as something that moves away from nation states, right? So seeing the failure of India as a nation state, or like, you know, just the politics that happens there, to thinking about what does decolonial solidarity means and what kind of movement do we need right now, both in the United States, but also expanding what, like, you know, not thinking of United States as a nation, right, as you're mentioning, this is, you know, we are on occupied land, and also doing a lot of work in Palestine, which, I mean, you should talk about, but, you know, doing a lot of work in Palestine, in New York City, doing that work means that you also do the work around indigenous struggle here. And for us, decolonization is really rooted in land, water, and air, right? A lot of, specifically women indigenous scholars have written about this, that we have to center that in terms of thinking about what decolonization means. So just from a movement context, we both were met in 2010, were in the photography school. I had just come from India. Amin was just leaving law, and he was bringing his Palestinian movement kind of organizing experience. And we both were just thinking about what would a movement or what would political practice mean, being in New York City. And, you know, Occupy Wall Street started around the same time, but we had also gone to Palestine in 2010. And it's kind of amazing to be in this space with all of these photographs here, because, you know, it's kind of symbolic to some of the work that we do. And Mohamed Bouzizi set himself on fire on January 25th in Tunisia. And that was like kind of a 2011 moment of things happening. And one of the things that Amin told me was like, we should go see what's happening with Occupy Wall Street. And I said, I don't care. I'm not from this place. Why would I care? And that was actually, I got involved as a filmmaker, and then I never made that film. There's still tons of footage lying around. But I got involved in the idea of thinking about what kind of a movement do we need to resist empire, imperialism, which is not just in the relation of the United States, right? And that's actually a place where Decolonize This Place comes from, is because so many movements are very Western-centric, and so what does it mean to actually think of decolonial solidarity that begins from the land that we are on, that is about thinking about now, you know, relationships outside of these borders that resist settler colonization here and in Palestine and colonization in India?
One of the ways to think about it is that, you know, decolonization is unsettling, and it should be. If it's comfortable for you to hear about it, it's not, you're not really getting at the complicity that we're all in different varieties and forms part of the problem. But the recognition that we're part of the problem then should open up a set of questions for us to ask about what does effective resistance looks like? Because ineffective resistance means that we're also propping up the status quo. Right? And then that becomes a bad book. You get yourself a job at an institution, and then you write and talk and represent other people while you're actually erasing what's happening. So I think that that's one. I think two is that really there isn't a definition for decolonization. It's always context specific. There are a set of principles, and you think from where you are. And I think it came up in the work that we were doing around the Brooklyn Museum, which is, there was a show, an exhibition called This Place, and that erased the Palestinian people and normalized the settler colonization of Palestine. So you saw people that looked like you, but they were families, they looked like they were families in Brooklyn, except they were in Palestine, right? They're very human, and then the others weren't, in the size of the figures, in all this stuff. So what does it mean to protest that exhibition when you recognize that you're on stolen land? It doesn't work. Right? So there's something about the exceptionalization of Palestine and our individual oppressions that we recognized is a problem, because it doesn't allow us to build power. So then how do we retain specificities of struggle and then simultaneously build the kind of decolonial relations that we need to have and the debts that we owe on this land, right, that we're benefiting from? So I think, like, in that framework, we recognize that the idea of social justice operating in the way we were experiencing it around class, around gender, around these things were just very isolated, and they were issue specific. And what we needed to do is to look outward and resist structures of oppression, but also deal with the oppression that we're multiplying on each other as a gentrifier, for example. But there's a question, right? Just on that simple point, displacement has long been happening, right? So the language that we use, and this is why decolonization becomes important, or you want to call it decoloniality and you want to get fancy, whatever, it doesn't matter. There's something about where knowledges are coming from and epistemologies that are actually inhibiting us from understanding and redefining natures of problems and potential solutions, even on a level of radicality. All right, you're anti-capitalist, so what are your solutions? They range from socialism to communism. Still part of the problem. It erases knowledges and knowings and medicines and possibilities. And it also seems to identify a means and an end when it's like, how can we prefigure now? How can we do the now? How can we recognize that we're creating futures all the time? This is what I mean by reorientation. You can look at it on a very basic level, and I'll end here. There's something, and I don't want to, I mean, what I think was said, and I think all the panelists said, and I think it's important to emphasize, there is not decolonization without land. So we are talking about, you know, land being returned. We are talking about the idea of property Xing that out. But that doesn't come on a platform of communism or anything like that. And the other, I mean, the land hasn't been ceded. So there's something about that that's really important, the land. But I am also a settler in New York City, right? I own that. So what does it mean to be a settler in New York City, right? And also be Palestinian, where I cannot return home or I cannot live there or whatever. These multiplicity of identities are important. But the thing that I want to say is, like, in the context of gentrification and displacement in New York City, there's a way in which you can own up to the act of gentrifying, knowing that we actually do not have anywhere to live that we can afford, right? Except by displacing other people of color. To me, the issue isn't whether you're a gentrifier or not. The issue is structural and bigger. So how are you going to activate within an analysis, right, that actually makes you speak to people that you needed to be speaking with in the beginning? And that's what we've done in our work.
Okay, thank you, Amin. Thank you, everyone. My name is Yasmin. I'm also a doctoral fellow, or Yasmin. it is the more appropriate pronunciation, I suppose. So in all of your work, the museum, the university, or the cultural center, those institutions have been critical in making these practices possible. But what role do they play in making coloniality visible or invisible, and making the practices of decolonization legible or illegible? So what role do the institutions play that you're affiliated with? Thank you.
I think about, just use the Middle East as an example, since there's a lot of Palestine energy up here. You know, might be a good place to start. And it gets at part of what you were talking about, which is a particular colonial framework forecloses on possibilities for how we can understand what the problem is and how we can imagine solutions, right? And so, for example, if particularly, again, just thinking about in a post-World War II context where the nation state is now kind of the germ of worth, where it becomes the primary sort of the telos of any kind of freedom, of any kind of freedom dream in this particular context, not everybody, but when we're talking about, you know, self-determination of nations, and we're using this kind of language, we're talking about a nation state. And the nation state has inherent in it a certain kind of structural violence. A certain kind of, it's very creation, it hinges upon violence, it hinges upon displacement, it hinges upon dislocation, and to some extent it's an imperial project. It is an imperial project, to some extent. And so therefore, even as we are imagining new possibilities of freedom, it's still delimited by this very particular framework called the nation state. Why is that important? Well, because if we're in the media and we're representing a struggle over land, right? I don't want to use the word conflict. If we're representing a struggle over land, if we're representing a resistance movement, particularly in Palestine, if two-state solution becomes, which is kind of like a liberal shibboleth at this point, like it's like kissing a baby, right? Two-state solution makes you normal. Anything else makes you an extremist. But the idea that you're fetishizing the state is itself foreclosing on all sorts of possibilities for what freedom can look like, for what self-determination can look like, for what humanity can look like. But we don't even allow room within the conversation for any alternative. Even if you say, well, I advocate a one state, right, which makes you, again, an extremist and all these other things, and, you know, you're still locked into this very narrow knowledge, because that's the only way that we can imagine freedom and self-determination. So as opposed to the language of sovereignty, we're deploying the language of a very particular type of government, governmentality that we're imagining. That, for me, is very dangerous. And so in the media representation, even as people are trying to adjudicate between competing claims about how a struggle should end, they're locked into a set of choices that shouldn't be the only choices on the table. And that, for me, becomes part of the challenge. And finally, even as we, again, talk about struggle over land and ownership, and even if we're having sort of historical debates or historically rooted debates about who owns the land or who had this or whether land was privately owned or publicly owned, still has you locked into a very particular framework. Whereas if we were to draw in indigenous frameworks, I mean, if you were to even look at Bedouin frameworks, or even if you were to go to the Ottoman era and look at like the Mutual land system, right? There are all these ways of understanding land outside the context of ownership, outside of a capitalist understanding of ownership. So when you say, well, no one owned it, we got here, no one owned it. Yeah, that might be true. But that doesn't necessarily mean that no one was on it and that no one had rightful possession of it. It just means that within your narrow framework, you can't understand rightful control over a space unless you own it and can keep it from other people. And so those types of frameworks, again, are narrow, and they shape our reading of history. Because then we go back in a presentist posture and say, well, look, they ain't on it. Oh, look, they didn't have this. Oh, this didn't happen. And then we start to make our own determinations based on the wrong framework. We're looking through the wrong lens. And so for me, part of decolonization within the media is to be able to intervene in that space and say, hey, wait a minute, y'all. Yeah, you're right. That's just not the point. Mm-hmm. And that's a hell of a conversation to have in 3 minutes. Yeah.
I'm going to speak as a PhD student who's trying to do work on actually decolonial media practices and art practices. So I just want to begin by saying I think that for me, I don't think of like the research and practice as separate, and decolonization is not supposed to be, it is knowledges and practices together, right? It is not this theory and practice dichotomy that we often talk about in the academy. And specifically, I think it relates to the program that I am in. It's a research practice program, and this is something that people love talking about, right? And so that's just one thing. And then the second thing is really also just like what knowledges are accounted for as knowledges and what are just considered like, oh, that's just poetry that, you know, is not relevant in the context of the work that we're doing. Which scholar are you referring to? Where are, you know, what's your bibliography? All of those things, right? And so, and then the third thing in this is like specifically because all my work that I do is under a collective name. Where are you, Natasha, in all of this work, right? What did you do, right? So like I'm in my fifth year of my PhD program and I'm just like trying to wrap up. But the thing that I've seen is that and also specifically with the idea of the decolonial turn, right? I didn't know that existed like at all. Somebody like sent me a link, did you see this? Or like the SCMS journal takes out decolonized media studies and then there's nothing about land there or land practices within media studies. And so all of these questions, I think there is this idea of, I think this comes from the institution's obsession with diversity and inclusion and not understanding what decolonization is, because that is a completely different project than diversity and inclusion, right? That's not what I'm interested in. So I'm automatically like put in a position which is not centered around their knowledges, and I'm trying to say this is something else that I'm trying to do. My practice is research, my practice is knowledge, my practice is all of these things. The people that are my community, I have to acknowledge them while I'm doing my work. I'm not an individual scholar or a thinker that is like some genius out there and who's gonna like, you know, all of those things. So those are, I think, the frictions that I'm having with the academy right now, specifically with my PhD program. And then like very quickly, which you already mentioned, is like, being termed as a violent person, right? Just because you're arguing, right? And the moment you bring in Fanon, then all hell breaks loose, right? Like, it's true. So, like, it's just like, oh, but that Fanon was, and I come from, I come from India and I know Gandhi's bullshit, right? So like nonviolent, like that's totally bullshit. And so he was a racist, sexist, all of those things. He didn't provide freedom to anybody, right? We know that. So here I am, like with all of my history sitting and like all of the work that I do, and I think that's the main problem. And I don't know, and I think this is really a conversation to be had while we're talking about decoloniality. Is there even a space? And I don't know, because it's extremely violent. And we know that the systems are extremely violent. We know students of color, and I'm an international student. And so on top of that, all of these different things, like what is considered as your practice and what is not. And so I have fought for a really long time, and I think I've created my own space, and I think just because of the work that I do outside of the academy, they really can't push me, right? Nobody can push me in the way they want. I've created my own practice and my own research methods. And so I think that's the biggest task for institutions, and I think this could be applied to museums. I mean, we do a lot of work in terms of the Brooklyn Museum, for example. The Whitney Museum is actually a great example, because this is the first time you actually have 50%, more than 50% of the biennial, which is artists of color, right? So this is a perfect tick mark for diversity. And so I think that, not to say that diversity and inclusion is not important, I think that is extremely important, representation is important, but that's not the horizon for decolonization, right? That's not where, and that's why land, water, air, all of these practices are central. Languages, as you mentioned, knowledges, these are all things that are extremely important to how we are thinking about it. And so if you think about academy, like why are PhDs only in English language, or why do we have to only think about thoughts, you know, specifically media studies also is extremely Eurocentric, right? And is not willing to open up in any ways. So yeah, that's it.
Thank you for touching on all those things, because now I feel like I have to say a lot less about the university. Because the university in and of itself is made as part of colonial rule. It is made to brainwash you into thinking that it's nationalist thoughts, that this nation is here to protect us, to love us. It's made to make you think in very specific terms that only allow for you to think about economics in terms of capitalism, and to not understand that there have been different relationships to material things, and between people trading material things. It has absolutely nothing to do with capitalism at all. And so universities are made to take your mind that could be expanded at a really great time in your life when you could meet a bunch of amazing people who could expand your mind a lot, and they're made to narrow you into very small, very particular ways of thinking. And you touched on all that, awesome. So I don't have to, cool, cut that down by like 5 minutes. So now I'm gonna talk about cultural spaces. And our cultural spaces that we create, both within universities, within museums, and all of these spaces, the places where we bring ourselves into spaces as Indigenous people, and we hold space for ourselves and each other, in and of itself is a decolonization practice. And those cultural spaces allow us to show our resilience, but they also are sites that highlight our continued struggle. So they show our continued resilience in that, again, we woke up, we showed up. We're talking to each other, we're talking about ourselves, we're being honest, we're being open, we're being here, and that in and of itself in a settler colonial state is resilience, it is resistance, it is liberation. For me to smile, for me to laugh, for me to live is resistance and resilience every day. There are people back home who don't get to do that. There are people back home who, from where I'm from, who don't have that opportunity, and so simply me sitting here and speaking to you is resistance and resilience, make no mistake. You see an Indigenous person sitting next to you, you see a Black person sitting next to you, you see a person of color sitting next to you, they are resisting and being resilient simply by waking up that morning and getting there. So we continue to show our resilience by showing up in cultural spaces, by holding cultural spaces within larger institutions, even thinking of a city as an institution. We show up in spaces where we are not meant to be. These spaces were not made for us, and they were made to be specifically exclusionary of us. Our classrooms are not places that speak of us, about our history, about our continued struggle. Our jobs are not places that speak of us or our continued struggles. Our activist spaces are not necessarily places that speak of us or our continued struggle. There are places that continue to erase us, maybe not even on purpose, simply because that is the framework in which we are living, and that is the framework in which we are thinking, is to think about Indigenous peoples not as peoples who exist today, now, in this space, and continuing to have struggles, but but people who exist maybe out there, maybe back when, we don't talk about the apartheid that continues to this day, which is why I grew up on a reservation and a lot of my people did not leave that space. I left, and that's unusual. We are able to exchange those stories in our back to cultural spaces. We're able to exchange those stories in our cultural spaces, and we're able to learn across cultures things that tools of settler colonialism that we would not be able to identify if we weren't able to speak across cultures and across spaces. To understand that in 2019, our indigenous women are still murdered within North America at a 50% higher rate is not something that we would be able to understand if we only lived in our own silos, in our own spaces. We wouldn't know that that is a continued act of genocide and settler colonialism if we weren't able to share that across cultures to say, oh shit, this is, again, sorry, this is happening to the Haudenosaunee, this is happening to the Taino, this is happening to the Estogana, this is happening to the Yakima, this is happening to the Inuit, this is happening indigenous people, is happening to the Palestinians, is happening to indigenous people across the world. We wouldn't have that ability if we didn't create cultural centers for ourselves. With the sharing of our struggle, we're also sharing our culture, we're sharing our identities, we're sharing our language, we're sharing our food, we're sharing our joy within these cultural spaces. And that is continued resilience. That is continuing decolonization, because that is doing what our ancestors have done from time immemorial. We have shared our struggle, and we have also shared our strength, and we have also shared our resilience, and we have also shared our strategies to fight settler colonialism, and we are continuing to do that to this day. Our warriors are continuing to come through, and they are continuing to say, hey, here's how the enemy fights. Here's how you can get a one-up on them. Because it is about land. It is about water. It is about air. It's about reclaiming our space. It's about continuing to live in a world that is literally murdering us, and that's not always going to look like pacifism, because it can't look like pacifism. It can't when we are literally being murdered to the extent that we are including murdering ourselves. We can't be pacifists. It's like we tried 500 years of that, and we really didn't, honestly, because we've been struggling violently this entire time. If y'all didn't know about that, look it up. I think that our cultural spaces also show our continued struggle within capitalist societies and with the colonial societies that don't want us here. Indigenous 215, people keep asking me if we have like a physical space. We don't, because we can't afford a physical space. There is not funding for us to have a physical space, because a lot of physical spaces are already owned by universities, are already owned by religious institutions, are already being bought up by developers. So there is no space where we can go and have Lenapes hold space within Philadelphia unless we ask one of those colonizing forces for permission to use one of their rooms or to use one of their spaces. And perhaps they will say yes, and perhaps that will come from guilt, and perhaps that will come from their understanding that giving us their shit is part of decolonizing. It's not yet, because I still don't have a house. Lenape still don't have gardens. They are still not being allowed to live here. If they are, they're being pushed out. So decolonizing only goes so far as to say, yes, I'll pencil you in to use my space, not I'm going to give you my space because it was yours. And so thinking about that, thinking about how hard it is to maintain spaces emotionally when the entire world is attacking you, when your identity is attacked, when you are not known as people, when you are invisibilized, because your invisibility continues to uphold the settler colonial state. Because keeping indigenous people in apartheid makes you think that we all died in the 1700s and 1800s. Because keeping us silent and painting this silent picture of us doesn't show you how enraged we are, and you feel safer. Because if we were really busy decolonizing, you wouldn't feel safe.
Maybe I can draw a little bit about from the Palestinian context, because I think it informs a lot of the conversation. I mean, what makes Palestine informative in this context is because you have multiple structures of oppression running through it. You have the settler colonial project, right, which is not an event. You have neoliberalism, right? You have flooding the society with debt, right? And people that look like you being your oppressors, which I think we should call into the room, for me as a Palestinian, right? Mahmoud Abbas, the PLO, the choices that were made, what's happening right now, they don't represent me. They don't represent my sisters. They don't represent a lot of people in Palestine. So there's something that Fanon had talked about this petty bourgeois and little people that get stakes in the overall structure. That's happening in Palestine. What does that mean? It means people like Bassel Arraj can be murdered, given up by the Palestinian Authority, where they can torture you in the same way because they learned all the lessons from the colonizer, right? So I think these are also facts. And I think that I bring them up not to air dirty laundry, right? But because we have to think differently about how we struggle. And I think that there's something that got brought in. When we talk about decolonization, and I teach at NYU, and I teach in the media studies, I teach in the art department, I'm an adjunct, I also teach at Gallatin. And so I'm like the token radical that gets put in a lot of places. But I think one of the things that I want to attest to is that my students, especially of color, are struggling and are experiencing violence from the institution. Like real violence, like the kind of violence that they may want to commit suicide, the kind of violence that they withdraw from a PhD program because the professor doesn't understand, the kind of violence that they're living with a roommate and they make comments about hair, the kind of violence, right? These things are real, and they're part of what it means to live under colonization and to be colonized and think about, as a professor, someone who's complicit in putting students in debt, right? That's the thing that we need to talk real about. Because most students graduate with debt right now. So what does it mean to be free? We need to talk about that. If freedom and self-determination was synonymous with the nation state, and we know how that turned out, a carceral kind of project, right, with varying degrees of oppression, then what does it mean to be free today when you have mortgages, student debt, healthcare debt, four corners of debt, and we get that from the Quebec movement. So what does it mean? I mean, debt is just time. Time. So if it means that you're going to be free when you're 60, if you're lucky, are you really free? The choices that you make in life, what job you choose, to work at JP Morgan, right? Or to be an organizer or an activist or someone who's actually engaged in struggle. Bassel Arraj is a person who is only 34 years old. And he resisted. And then when he was in his room, and they found a Fanon book in Ramallah, actually El-Bira, right? But one of the things that he said, he's like, for all the intellectuals in Palestine, the Palestinians, it's like, fuck you and your intellectualism if you're not engaged. You need to be engaged in the struggles, and you need to recognize your complicity, not so you can be debilitated in the process, but so that you can figure out how to build. Because there is power for people that have outlets to speak about. But what are you saying? If you're saying things that reinforce white supremacy, patriarchy, then you're talking about healthcare and some kind of vision. No, you're not useful. Now I want to say, now what do I do in my classroom? I try to, right now I have two students that are doing internships with DTP, Decolonize This Place. I have two students that are doing independent study, right, with what? Other organizations. I find ways. We do all our printing at NYU in color. That's how we do our shit, right? We have access to the entire building. I have a letter right now, all the people, because the space is there. You should not have space. But it requires us to think differently. And, you know, you want to give this some kind of intellectual resonance, you can say Fred Moten in the Undercommons. But there's ways to actually use what you have at your disposal in ways that unsettle this, and you don't have to choose between being poor and run over, right? But are you using your privilege strategically? The other thing I want to say is that we're not used to conflict. And I think points of conflict are points of construction, if you're invested in it, right? And I think that's real. So there is no liberation that's not going to come with all of us. But you can't tell me just be united for some something, because unity at this moment is oppressive. Unity will produce the same outcomes we're living in, just someone else in certain chairs, in certain parties. So the work needs to be real and needs to happen now, and it happens day in and day out.
I'm Florence. I'm a CARG doctoral fellow. And I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit more on how you have navigated taking risks and making concessions, and sort of how do you see the impulse to revolution or reform?
I don't believe in binaries. I think that that's a binary that's existed for a really long time. I've seen a lot of movements like fall apart just because of thinking about revolution and reform. And I think that, for me, it's very similar to the diversity inclusion conversation, right? Which is, for me, I think that's very important, like, you know, reforming the institutions that exist. But at the same time, I don't think of that, you know, as something that's like the horizon for justice or the, you know, things like that. So I think for me, what's really important is that when we think about decolonization, right, we don't think of it, this is the goal to decolonize, and once we've reached there, we have decolonized. Because that's just like, you know, it's an ongoing process. It's an ongoing process of so many things, and learning, centering land, centering languages, centering, you know, decentering whiteness, all of these things, dismantling patriarchy, and, you know, the relationships between each other, reorientation. There's so much work that needs to be done that it's an ongoing process. So I really don't think of it in terms of that, in terms of a binary that exists. And I think Amin already said that, but like working from where we are and like what our position is, and like working from our own position and where we are in our lives, and thinking about decolonization from that context. But you know, I mean, I think you know, when we started Decolonize This Place, actually, we just took one paragraph from Decolonization Is Not a Metaphor, written by Eve Tuck and Kay Wayne, which literally in one paragraph talks about the different relationships that exist for to think about decolonial solidarity, let's say in the United States. And that's also text that talks about the difference between social justice and decolonization. And so I think that would be really helpful to think about this, like reform and revolution.
And maybe if I can tag on just really quickly, like personal experience, right? So, and I think because I think you need to ground it, these questions are not abstract, our lives are not abstract. So you know, I came here when I was 20, I had lived in Palestine. I was a member of Fatah. I had gone to jail twice. Like, I was part of that resistance movement. Then I came over here, studied philosophy, and then law school. When I graduated from law school, the immediate thing I had to deal with is my parents understanding what I'm doing, right? Because what do you need to make some money. You need to support us and support your sisters, right? So there was a thing where I went into law so I can make money. I was no one, you know, law is not justice. Gayatri Spivak says that. So let's be really clear. But I think law is also a tactic. I wasn't going in because it's a tactic. I was going in just because I needed to make money. And I worked on Wall Street. Like, that's what I did. I was doing structured finance, Islamic structured finance, for JP Morgan, Citibank, those kind of places. And I, you know, when I was when I was interviewed, they're just like, so you're Palestinian, because they wanted to hire me. I actually sold myself, right, to Zionists. They're just like, okay, our clients are from Kuwait and from Saudi Arabia, and they're wealthy people. So they need to kind of do their thing Islamic, and you speak Arabic, that's your first language, great. So what do you think of suicide bombings? They're morally repugnant. I don't believe anyone can do that. Da, 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 da. Why? Because I wanted the money. I got a full ride at Columbia. I had to sign a paper that says I support the two-state solution. Right? But I did it. Do you see what I'm saying? Because it's sequencing in your life. There is no purity in this. And decolonization is not about purification. It is really about tactics and strategies and figuring out your moves, because for me, the struggle was supporting my two sisters and supporting my father and my mother, right? And that's what I did, but I gave myself 5 years. I gave myself 5 years and then I was out, and that was my 34th birthday, right? And what did I do? I was on EBT within a week on EBT. I was getting the health care, I was set. Because, you know, look, let's be real honest. We just want to retain our comforts. There's something about fighting for freedom and liberation that exacts a cost. And people under colonial rule, the Palestinians, all these people, this doesn't make colonial sense to actually go face a tank, throw a rock, do these kind of things. You're valuing life differently. You're valuing time differently. You're valuing relations differently. You have not succumbed to it. And when a tank goes into a village or a refugee camp, it is not, right, counterinsurgency. What it is destroying your spirit to think differently, to feel differently. So then it's not about do this, not do that. Is what are you doing it for? And are you being honest with yourself in the process? And I think that's really, that comes with a lot of responsibility on your part and a lot of questions. But I prefer a politics of questions, right? Than someone giving me a script and say, run with it.
At the same time, you would probably concede that there are moments where the individual choice, which comes out of a particular ethic or a particular moral agenda, might need to be reimagined or reshaped, given, right? You may reconsider and say, you know, maybe that Wall Street thing wasn't the right move.
Or maybe, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. No, I know you know that. I wanted to make sure that got tied up at the end. So.
Occupy Wall Street was a bad, bad move. Bad
move. Believe me, I done made some bad ones too. I worked at Fox News, you know what I mean?
Hey, oh, shit.
So I was on the visiting team, but still, like, it comes from a place, you know, I'm not saying this from a place from moral high ground.
Yeah.
But I both of what you're saying is so fascinating to me, and what you've been saying is so fascinating to me, and I agree so much. The binary itself, we have to trouble and ultimately probably destroy, and be mindful of these things tactically. You know, how does this particular move lead us down this road versus that road? Mm-hmm. I think about it in two spaces. I mean, there are moments where reforms often make people's lives better. And they're seductive because they make people's lives better. And you can make a good faith argument that that it's a privilege to be able to take an ideological position that has a long-term value, but that causes some kind of suffering in the short term. I'll give you an example. Those of us who voted Green, mm-hmm. right? People say that's an academic position, that's a privileged position, that's a middle-class position, because people are catching hell right now by virtue of that guy in D.C. And if you didn't vote for Hillary Clinton, then you actually made a kind of counter-revolutionary move because you created more suffering. I don't accept that position. I think that's a bullshit position, to use your language, your phrase. But I do think I think the conversation needs to happen, right? The politics of questions needs to be invoked in such a way that we're able to sort of, on the one hand, keep track of immediate suffering and ask some really tough questions about what short-term means, but also be able to imagine something bigger and something longer. I've been part of the prison abolition movement since I was a teenager. And when you look at the folk who started critical resistance, you know, in the West Coast, one of the big challenges around prison abolition was, how do you, in real time, make decisions around reform that may not be abolitionist as such, right? So there are reforms that I can make in prison that will make someone's life better tomorrow. Prison libraries help people. Lowering the cost of phones help people. We could name lots of things in prison that we could reform that would help people. But what they do is they normalize the presence of the prison itself, and they make you believe that the prison is reformable. But when sexual assault is happening, do you not stop it? When people need condoms in prison, do you not provide them? When books, you know, allow people to engage differently, or when phone calls allow people to get closer to their families and be able to, which reduces recidivism. When we have these kinds of things, do we not do them out of some ideological deference, right? So, again, I don't have an answer, per se. Academics, we don't get paid to have answers as much as the trouble stuff, but at the very least, I struggle with this, and a lot of times the question for me has been, or the answer, rather, has been, can this reform ultimately undermine the revolutionary possibility, mm-hmm. or not? So for me, a prisoner strike, supporting a prisoner strike, or supporting better food in a prison, does not undermine an abolitionist agenda. Getting rid of cash bail, or Obama advocating for cash bail or the elimination of cash bail on the federal level, to me, doesn't necessarily violate an abolitionist impulse, even though Obama ain't an abolitionist by any stretch. Now, Oslo, you can make a case, I mean, let me be careful. There were people in 93 who made a good, or not even as early as 91, who made a good faith argument for Oslo being the Oslo Accords being a helpful reform and form of redress and an ultimate pathway to Palestinian self-determination. They were wrong because it rested on many assumptions that the Israelis were operating in good faith, that a two-state solution was the right outcome. Again, going back to the nation-state argument, all these things were possible. But you could, to me, you didn't need a crystal ball to say that one wasn't going to make a whole lot of sense because it didn't rest on the proper values or the kind of proper revolutionary tactics. So I'm not saying all reforms make sense, even though they could reduce ostensibly short-term suffering. I think we have to have these debates and these conversations. But those are the struggles that we have, and I think we have to navigate those struggles. And in terms of outside the political realm, when I think about the work, because the question was also about how do we navigate that in our own worlds. On TV, I navigate it all the time, right? There are conversations you don't have on TV because there's just no space to have it, right? So when a cop kills people, right, running away, when a cop is shooting Walter Scott running away, and the debate is, well, is it possible that Walter Scott was going to circle back and kill this cop, although he was unarmed, or, you know, what would Rodney King have done to those five cops had they not beaten them, right? These ridiculous arguments, right, that are in bad faith. The question is, should the cops go to jail? As an abolitionist, that's not how my mind goes. I don't like being in Ferguson marching to send all these crooked cops to jail. You know what I mean? I don't want to heighten the bail on a cop in Baltimore, not because I think because I like cops or because I want anything to happen to these unarmed black people, but because that's not the proper response. As an abolitionist, I have a different idea of how to address harm, and it's not through the lens of criminality. But there's no space for that complexity on MSNBC or CNN or Fox News or anywhere else, right? So you almost have to take the case of, yeah, lock the cop up, not because you believe in prison, but because you're trying to, there's a bigger looming presence of white supremacy that's trying to undermine the value of this black life on the ground. And so I'm trying to fight for that black life, and so I don't have the space in that moment to make the case for abolition, because I'm trying to make the case that these people are worth something. And so that's a short-term compromise that you can sometimes elaborate in other spaces, and then sometimes you get in other spaces and you get jacked up too. So you got to figure out what that's going to look like. Yeah.
Liberation for indigenous people on this land, and liberation for indigenous people on any land means the annihilation of the settler colonial state. Full stop. That's just what it is. And so in relation to that, everything that I do is going to be a concession until I'm actively getting rid of the settler colonial state. So I'm making concessions every day. And sometimes that's what you do in order to make sure that your family eats, in order to make sure that your loved ones can continue to breathe. Because perhaps we are not ready yet for a complete annihilation of the settler colonial state. We're getting ready again. Best believe we've been getting ready. So reform in the sense, reform, I think that reform, there are a lot of indigenous folks who are really excited about reform. We're really excited about having people in spaces of legislation. We would be probably really excited about having a Native president. We're really excited about having Native people in Congress. We're really excited about having Native lawyers. We're really excited about having Native doctors. We're really excited about having Native academics. And all those people are great. Don't get me wrong. I know amazing Native doctors. I know amazing Native lawyers. I know amazing people who are bringing their indigenous identity and their indigenous knowledge to a space. Because when you are a Native doctor speaking to Native patients, you are not only bringing the information that was taught to you in medical school, you're also bringing the information that was taught to you by your grandmother. And you're bringing the information that was taught to her by her grandmother, and hers, and hers, and hers. So you are bringing thousands of years of resistance and thousands of years of knowledge into a space. And you are looking someone in the eye and you are saying that I see your resistance and I see your knowledge and I see your grandmother's wisdom. And you're able to talk about that and you're able to have that space. And people, Native lawyers, can talk to you about the difference between how indigenous people perceive land, as you were speaking about earlier, and how settler colonial states and how Europeans perceive land and private property ownership. And that's really important when you live under a settler colonial state, to have someone who can just translate what the fuck they're saying. That's how we got here in the first place. Some territories are unceded, some aren't. All of them are bullshit because all of them were stolen from us. Even the ceded territories we were tricked into giving up. Because we couldn't read their legalese, because we don't know what that piece of paper says, because the way that we think of land, space, relationship to people, to animals, to each other, was not the same understanding that those coming to steal our land and rape our women and commit genocide against us had. It was a different respect. It was a different humanity that we thought existed in these people that maybe does. Largely, maybe doesn't. It's up to you to decide. But reform is really exciting us because reform is giving us representation. And representation is really, really nice when no one's ever looked like you, when no one's ever known your struggle, when you never had a professor stand in front of you and speak in their native language. Having a professor stand in front of you and speak in their native language is enough to make you bawl your eyes out because you feel seen, because you feel heard, because you feel like someone's going to understand, because you know that this professor, unlike all of your white professors, this professor is going to stand in front of you and they're going to say, you know what, that scholar who just came out with that, they're valid. You know what, you as a scholar, you're valid. You bringing in your grandmother's wisdom is valid. You bringing in your oral history and your oral tradition is valid. They will validate you, and that means a lot. Knowing that there are people in positions of power to make legislation who are currently talking about missing and murdered Indigenous women, when before the only people talking about missing and murdered Indigenous women were us, talking about our sisters, our aunts, our mothers, our kids. To know that means a lot. But that isn't going to bring about our revolution. That isn't going to bring about our liberation. That isn't going to bring about change. That's going to make us feel a little more comforted as we're being choked to death. That's going to be someone squeezing a little bit less hard on our throats. That's going to be someone saying they're sorry before shooting us in the head. That's going to be someone saying, here's some lettuce, as they continue to give us, I don't know, fucking flour and lard, and they continue to put us in food deserts as if we did not travel our earth to get our food from different places, as if we don't have this knowledge of the land. That'll get us having land acknowledgments instead of land back. So reform's cute, but reform doesn't make me free. Reform doesn't mean that my people get to speak our language. It means that we get to sit and appreciate our elders a little more, but what does it mean if our elders don't have heat? What does it mean if our elders don't have food? Reforms are cute, but they don't stop our women from going missing. They don't stop our children from being raped. They don't stop our lives from being taken. Reforms are cute. That's really all they are. We need to be revolutionary because to be revolutionary means that we don't believe in these systems, we believe in the people. We believe in people to create better systems, we believe in people to create a better world, we believe in people to create something different than we have now. So reforms are cute, but they aren't going to bring about liberation.
Okay, so my name is Heather, thank you all. I'm a doctoral student at CARG as well. And my question is about feeling. So one of the threads through our research tomorrow that's gonna be presented is an attention to affect and feeling. And then recently in this room, actually a month ago, as was mentioned, Walter Mignolo spoke about coloniality in terms of emotion. And he said, you know coloniality because you feel it. It's a common understanding. People across places feel it. It's not a conceptual understanding, it's an emotional one. So thinking about that and thinking about your own work and your sort of strategies you've been talking about, what does it mean to feel coloniality?
I mean, just to give you an example in the classroom, I think that one of the ways in which I run, for example, a classroom is I treat it as like a space to allow space for knowledges. Right, I have nothing, you know, I only have my lived experience, right? But I think each of us has a lived experience, and it's similar to what the initial statement was, where it's just like thinking from where you are. All these powers and forces, and I don't think we've been talking about power enough, that fixes meaning, that does all of these things in terms of power. But I think that, you know, in my classroom, it's about lived experience and knowledges. So then how can we facilitate radical pedagogical spaces of learning from each other, where you're not just taking the knowledge from the institution and putting it back out, which then produces the clog in the machine that kind of keeps up white supremacy, capitalism, these structures of oppression, right? So I like to think of it as lived experience. I know what oppression feels like, but I know what my oppression feels like, you know, and that comes from a colonial context, but it also comes from living here, in which I am not colonized in the same. I'm not indigenous to this land, right? So that's all I wanted to say. I think that one of the ways to switch that question is that, you know, Walter Mignolo is speaking from Latin American context, fine, right? Right? Yeah. And I think, but that's great, that's fine. You know, coloniality, decoloniality, all these phrases that we try to coin, right, that becomes very academic. And so, and then he talks about it to validate the fact that you just feel oppression and you know it. So it's like our lived experience. That's, you know, then we have to deal with the problem of like, how do we talk about it amongst communities, right, in a way that isn't intellectual? So then we got to move away from coloniality and decoloniality. And what's the difference between coloniality and colonization, right? And what's the difference between decolonization and indigenizing, right? All of these things that you have to tease out, and you just end up going in this damn circle where everyone, a conversation that includes these many people involved in it. I think one of the ways to ask about that question is, how are we holding space for each other? How are we decentering power? How do we recognize there's nothing inherently bad or good about power, but your relationship to it, relationally? Power over, power under, power with, power within. These are forms, and these are domination, oppression, you know, empowerment, these kind of things in spaces. And I think every space we're in today needs to be a space in which we both reclaim or hold for other people. And the fact that we're doing that, we're trying to do that or talk about it, is what's more interesting, because one of it just keeps us in a conversation of going in a circle. Another one can use this kind of thing for the revolution that we're trying to usher. Right? There's how many people here? This is what I'm trying to say, is like the separation between what we're thinking about and how we're holding space is something that we need to think further about. Because these knowledges that I'm sharing are a product of 10 years of failure in my whole life. Yeah. Me sharing it doesn't really do much to it, right? Thanks.
What I was trying to think about when you asked, what does it mean to feel coloniality? For me is to, I think the key for me as a precondition of feeling it is to locate new sites of possibility for the articulation of certain sensibilities, decolonial sensibilities. I'm not to say that we can't have these moments in our classroom, because I think we can, but as you talked about earlier, the university itself is such a problematic space, and it's so riddled and shot through with particular formations of power that it can be difficult to imagine new sites of freedom within that location. That's not to say it can't happen. Resistance work happens everywhere, possibly. But what I've been trying to do in my own work is think about new spaces to do it. So the scholarly text is a way, of course, you can always do it, but even epistemologically, we're locked in a certain ways of framing arguments, right? Certain ways of certain empirical methods that we use. All these things may foreclose on possibilities. And so for me, I've been just trying to find other places where people are sitting with those tensions and sitting with those contradictions and sitting with the kind of trauma of colonial violence. For the last 5 years, I've been doing field work in Palestine, particularly in East Jerusalem, more particularly in the African quarter of East Jerusalem. And part of what I've been trying to do is think about colonial power through a racialized framework, so that we can think about the way that race and racial formation also operates within different colonial states in different ways, right? So that's why the film's called Black and the Holy Land. Both Black and Holy Land have like imaginary quotes all around them, right? Because I'm trying to imagine these spaces differently. And for me, the genre of film and the space of film has given me a new opportunity, a different way of thinking about the feeling of coloniality and the tension and contradictions of coloniality in a way that the scholarly text just hasn't been able to. For me, that's not to say it can't happen there, but for me, that hasn't been the space where I've seen it most productive. When I'm not filming or doing field work, I spend some time at the Hakoati Theater, which is part of the Palestinian National Theater, and there's a wonderful, very old project there and building there in East Jerusalem, or in Sheikh Jarrah, right outside of East Jerusalem, right outside of the old city. And some of the interesting Palestinian theater that happens there, it's sort of Brechtian in a way, and it's even Boalian in a way. And I'm suddenly feeling really academic, but it's there's this way that they're engaged in almost theater of the oppressed kind of performances, where it's not static, where it's not prescripted, but where the audience themselves can intervene, where they can reimagine and redirect people, where outcomes can be changed, where the play itself or the performance itself is happening in real time in response to the needs and the imaginations and the conditions of the people in the immediate audience. And so to that extent, there's a way at moments where certain things are being corrected or being changed. Darin Tatur was there. Let me pause on Darin real quick. There was a, so when they're there, it's another way to understand and feel the kind of tension and the contradiction that people are wrestling with in their own lived experience. And that for me, and sometimes is more instructive than me doing a structured interview. Although structured interviews are awesome and grad students do them and graduate and, you know, get tenure and all that awesome stuff. But post that, or in addition to that, you finding these other spaces to imagine new possibilities for me has been incredible. Film, a live performance, music, all these things have been, for me, just new sites of possibility.
So I tend to think about things, and so I'm going to try to stick to a feelings narrative about this instead of a thought narrative about this. Colonization and coloniality feels heartbreaking, enraging, and optimistic. And it feels like holding all of those things at the highest level humanly possible, all at the same time, and still somehow finding room for other emotions and not really knowing how you're doing that. It feels heartbreaking because every day I wake up and I see people who haven't. It feels heartbreaking because I go down my newsfeed and I see shit that's still happening to indigenous folks around the world. It feels heartbreaking because I see people who don't think that they can do anything else, because the world has told them that they can't do anything else. It's heartbreaking because people don't know that they have ways to get out of this outside of alcohol, outside of meth, outside of suicide, outside of violence, outside of rage, outside of abuse. It's heartbreaking because to see the effects of colonialism on my community today, to see how we police each other, how we participate in the destruction of other communities, to see how, going back to someone else's point about having oppressors who look like you, to see how the US government has made these fake IRA governments, the Indian Reorganization Act, how they have made these fake governments who stand on top of us but don't represent us, because they were never our governments to begin with. They were something that the colonial rule said, here is a reform that we'll give you. Here is something that we will recognize. But those are not our clan mothers speaking. Those are some men playing chief. Those are not our people. They do not have our interests in mind. They have the same capitalist and colonial interests in mind that the oppressors do. And to see my people go through that every day, to see them live under that every day, to see them live under the weight of colonialism every day is heartbreaking. To see us not know how to break the cycles of abuse, how to break the cycles of trauma, because those are all that we know and those are all that we are allowed to know, is heartbreaking. I'm enraged because I know that none of those cycles of abuse, none of those cycles of trauma are ours. We didn't wake up one morning saying that we wanted to do this, that we wanted to hurt ourselves, that we wanted to hurt each other. I'm enraged because those are all things that have been put on us. Because the settler colonial state, the state that is currently in power, came to us. They murdered us. They told us that this is the way that we had to think. They took our children away from us. They took our lives away from us. They took our land away from us. They take our food away from us. They took our traditions and our cultures away from us. And they said, this is how we have to live. This is how we have to assimilate. This is how we're going to survive. I am enraged because my people don't get to survive, and my people don't get to live, and my people don't get to thrive because that was taken from us. And I'm also optimistic because we're still speaking our language, because we still have our culture, because my Allah still told me of the berries, of the fish, of the salmon. She still can point out of our window and say, this is our land and these are our ways. I feel optimistic because no matter how much indigenous people have genocide committed against us, both in the past and in the current, we are still here. We are still taking up space. We are still forcing you to hear us. We are still forcing you to put us on your panels. We are still forcing you to let us in this space because we deserve to be here and because we know that. I'm optimistic because I know that indigenous people are not being silent, that we are continuing no matter how many times we are pushed down, no matter how many times we are murdered, no matter how many times we are siloed, no matter how many times we are put in positions to think that we don't deserve to be here, that we don't deserve to take up our space. No matter how many times that's happened, we continue to say no. We continue to say that we deserve to live, we deserve to survive, and we deserve to thrive. And so I'm extremely optimistic because indigenous people are continuing to be empowered. They are continuing to take the space that we have always deserved. We are continuing to be the badass organizers and the badass indigenous people that we are. And we are doing that every day. Even we are doing that through reform, we are doing that for revolutionary means, we are doing that for our people. And everything that we do for our people. And so I'm very optimistic, even as I am really fucking angry, even as I'm really fucking sad. I also really believe in the power of us. And I believe in the power that we have. We keep talking about power, and we think about power as those who are in power have the control. But they are only in power, and they only have control because we cede that power to them. And so as soon as we say that power is irrelevant, that your title is bullshit, that is when we take our power back. And so I'm excited because I see indigenous people doing that. I'm optimistic because I see a lot of other people following step, getting in line and following indigenous lead. And so again, it's only a matter of time before the revolution happens. It's going to be led by indigenous and black folks. So get ready, get excited, or get out of the way.
I think for me, the way I understood, like, I think for me, of course, it's like a lot of anger and just being pissed off, just like simply just being very pissed off. But I think for me, it has been like not understanding what they call logic. Right? Like the absurdity of coloniality, right? For me, the absurdity is the thing that I just can't get my head around it. Like, so people might say this is what coloniality might look like, but just like the absurdity of, let's say, the occupation in Palestine, or the absurdity of like living in patriarchal orders, the absurdity of all of this just really like drives me insane. And, you know, growing up, I've always been like somebody who doesn't fit in into a lot of context or communities or all of these things that are often given to you to accept. And so I think for me, it has always been put in the way I think of them as absurd situations and not understanding why I can't do a certain thing or like why something is this way. And I think that the way I would say that, I mean, I think it's also generational knowledges, right? So it's not something, you know, that I'm not just this blob of time that has come in, right? So knowing that I got this from my mother, my grandmother, all of these things, like my family, both my chosen family and my, you know, family that I have. So I think that for me, it has been really just really trying to understand time, not in this linear way that I was brought up in, right? You'd like be on time. Natasha, you're always late. I'm always late. I'm always late, right? So like that's something that I have been like, you know, and also come, you know, growing up in a Sikh community, we're always late. Like everybody's always late. But just understanding that the time or the linearity of time is also a colonial structure. And so like keeping, like trying to understand that and knowing that, you know, how am I going to manage within this time and space that is given to me, right? There isn't a place that has been outside of the system. And so how am I going to place myself within that, right? So saying no to certain things, saying yes to certain things, like all of those things. And then I think that a lot of it has already been said, but I think that keeping the generosity and care, right? Like keeping the generosity and care that you have, because that's one of the things that coloniality does, is like it wants to take away everything that you have, right? Like debt is one of those things. Like the moment you have debt, you don't have time. You know, knowing that when somebody comes to your house, offering them food and tea, that should just be like a contract, like that should just be a given thing. Like, for example, filming in Palestine, like I would be in Nablus filming and somebody from nowhere, I don't even know them, there'll be like tea and biscuits for me to eat, right? You know, that, so these are these, like, this is very small, but these everyday relationships I think are really important, and to keeping hold of them, no matter where you are, like, to making sure that when people who are around you are fed, are like, you know, and I know that I have the privilege of, like, coming up with resources to be able to do that. And so I think that that is like the way I think about, I'm answering this question in a very personal way, because I think that that for me is creating spaces of care, spaces of generosity, spaces of listening, spaces of feeling, like, because that's a privilege, right? People don't have the time to feel. And I think that's very important. And that's why I think the anger, the generosity, the care, the time, all of those things are extremely important.
Thank you, guys. Okay, so this is the last question. And in order to be mindful of giving the audience some space, I'm going to put the question into this space. If you have a kind of brief answer you can give to what is a very big question, I would invite you to do so. And then we can let this question continue into the reception and other time. So the question is, what does allyship and solidarity look like in your work?
I'll give a short answer. Because I think solidarity and allyship, they're very complicated things, and I think we all have our own idea what solidarity looks like. And unpacking that would take hours. I'll talk about the context of my own work of Black Palestinian solidarity. There are a few things that I've noticed. One is that solidarity talk tends to be, particularly in the transnational context, often seems to be thinking about what happens when the global South, folk in the global South end up engaging folk in the global North. There's very little talk about solidarity, South-South solidarity, for example, right? There's not a whole lot of talk of what's happening in those contexts, which I think is important because it decenters us. So part of what we have to do when we talk about solidarity is imagine it in different, from different valences and different vantage points. Another thing when I think about solidarity is I think we have, there's a way that it can become transactional that I find uneasy. When we were in Ferguson, we started, I mean, one of the most, it's almost become cliche now to talk about the kind of tweets from Ramallah that came in the wet, in Ferguson, but we were in Ferguson in the summer of 2004 at the same time that Gaza was being bombed, and Gaza was being bombed in July and August. We were in Ferguson from August 9th forward, and as we were getting tear gassed by St. Louis police, Miriam Barghouti and other people were tweeting us, like, here's how you wash your eyes out, here's how you run against the wind, here's how you make makeshift gas masks, here's how you, all these things, based on their own experiences in the West Bank, because they were like, hey, we're facing the same kind of power structure and the same kind of spectacular forms of state violence, and here's how you resist. And so many people talked about that as a form of solidarity. And I do think that that's a kind of, I think that's like a snapshot or a moment of solidarity possibility. I'm not sure that that's, but we often reduce solidarity to those kinds of things. And I think that's cool. And then Ferguson, people started, you know, chanting Ferguson to Palestine, occupation is a crime. And then we started doing delegations to Palestine, and we started kind of physically being there. And it was almost like, if you show up for us, we show up for you. And I think that when you frame solidarity in that way, solidarity becomes almost another market. It gets shot through with market values and becomes another thing that becomes transactional. You do this for me, I do this for you. Another thing I noticed, particularly in the context of Black Palestinian solidarity, is a lot of it is predicated upon sameness, right? I show solidarity to the extent that I can recognize my condition as similar to yours. So when we were looking at people who were like emissions committees in the Galilee, and you're like, oh wait, they can't live there because they're Black. Oh, I can get that. You know, I need to do something about that. Or, oh, they're taking homes, or people are moving in and we're getting kicked out. Oh, that's kind of like gentrification. I can kind of get that. And it seemed like even as people were making sense of the condition, it was rarely emic, right? It was rarely through the lens and experiences of the people there. It was all very much on the terms of us. So, and it was like our motivation and our engagement oftentimes was to the extent that we could say, oh, they're like us. Even the idea of Blackness, right? It was like, oh, I'm looking at Afro-Palestinians in Jerusalem, or I'm looking at Afro-Bedouins in Beersheba, or I'm in Jericho, and these folk. And there were some folk who were like, yo, I'm Afro-Palestinian, I'm cool, I'm black, I'm down. But for the most part, that wasn't how people understood their identity. And this idea of blackness, we were looking at through a very, very particular American-centric, Western-centric, but also American-centric racial frame. And in doing so, we racialized them in ways that they wouldn't understand themselves to be. But we were like, yo, we're going to rock with them because there's black folk over there, so we got to do it. And there's some practical value to that. If you want to help people in Jericho or Gaza because you think they black, cool. And phenotypically they are, but my point is that it's just identity is a very complex thing. But what happens when you run out of room? You run out of field that way, right? There's going to come a moment where I'm like, okay, well, I can kind of get you, and not pointing to you, you know what I'm saying, you're 48, but like, I could get you in Nazareth, and I could get you in Haifa, because, you know, your condition's kind of like, but what happens when you're just in El Bir or Ramallah, like you mentioned, and you're just stateless, right? I can't wrap my mind around that in the same way. What's my inclination, right? I guess what I'm saying is, for me, solidarity has to have a higher moral impulse. And a different kind of end game that isn't predicated upon me being like you, you being there for me in a way that I need you to be. There has to be a deeper and a broader and more long-term moral and ethical and political project that says that whether you're a Yazidi in Iraq or whether you're in Uganda, as a queer body in Uganda, it doesn't matter where you are, I have to have an investment in you because of your fundamental humanity and because these broader structures are overdetermining all of our understandings of the world and are shaping our realities on the ground. Until we dismantle that stuff, white supremacy, patriarchy, homophobia, capitalism, none of us gonna get anywhere. And so that has to be the predicate for our solidarity project, not the kind of almost, I can't think of the word, but this begins with this kind of self-obsessed kind of position from which to operate.
Well, not to make you visible, Jaskiran, but Jaskiran Dhillon is here, and she talks about being a political accomplice versus an ally. And I think that's very important, like being a political accomplice, which is what you're also saying, that we're right now asking you to sketch in our name in the space, but the space is ours, right? And so I think that's the question for, like, you know, what would it mean for me to be solidarity, knowing that I'm a guest here? So, like, knowing that I can't own any of this, right? Changing your relationship to property, like thinking about your life not as like, oh, I'm going to get a house and then in the system and then I'm going to live in this way. How are we living? It's a very simple question of how are we living and how are we changing those relationships? And then, you know, just like coming, and then there's several examples. Like, I do come from a community that's anti-black, so doing the work at home. I do come from a community that's Islamophobic, doing that work. So I think that's also just like, you know, doing the day-to-day practice work, and so that's, I think, very important. And then the other thing I think I just want to say is the work specifically with Decolonize This Place has been to kind of create the solidarity that is built on this idea of being an accomplice versus an ally. Like, if you're not down for, like, you know, land being, like, you know, returned, then you're not part of this, right? You know, it's really simple. If you're not for abolition, like, there's no question. Like, we're not even going to have that conversation. And I think that's why, like, things like movements like Decolonize, not to say that just because I'm part of it, but there are many movements, I'm just talking about that as an example, is that they keep things moving, right? Zapatistas is one way of thinking about that, right? They keep things moving. Walking while you ask questions, all of these things. And so I think that a lot of, like, you know, a lot of what we're talking about here actually gets hashed out on the streets and also in living rooms and also over food, over drinks, and over all of these things. And I think that's important to talk about, right? And also just like knowing that to be able to give up resources, very important to be able to give up resources, which is related to power. And I think it's going to be unsettling, right? It is going to be uncomfortable for you to give up your power. Right, and that's, I think, important for the things that we are thinking of creating.
I think that just to kind of tag on to Decolonize This Place, because it's one answer, right, and it's very material. We come from movements that have failed, right, a series of them. They've done amazing stuff, but they've also failed in a certain respect. And I think, you know, I'm just going to tell a story to kind of say how complicated it is, but how useful movement-generated stuff is. And this is where we come from. So Occupy Wall Street, problem with the name. We fought very hard against it, right? As a Palestinian, there were 500 emails that went back and forth around the concept of 99%. The impulse was good. You don't want to represent other people and their grievances and their demands. So what do? You just put 99%, you define a thing that would be us by the enemy, and then you come together and you figure it out. Problem with that is that it largely became white. Part of it was the media representation, and it was became just about class and US centric. Lost on a lot of arguments, still participated in it, right? And tried to direct it in a particular way, and we were, more or less very, very involved. Okay. Lessons learned from that. If you don't have racial justice at the center of any movement in the US, doesn't work. But again, I'm speaking for myself, right? Black Lives Matter happens and the movement for Black Lives. So you see a conversation happening. There's a corrective things that are going on, right? A lot of the resources that we had in New York, we put it towards that movement, right? But at the same time, it was us thinking through mistakes. And we come and you see Standing Rock, right? And you recognize it's in a very material way, right? The pipeline was telling you that the settler colonial project is still ongoing. It is about the annihilation of indigenous people, and it won't stop until that happens, right? And because of the resistance, it exists, it's just not rendered visible, or we don't recognize it, right? So with that, we may decolonize this place 5 years to the date after Occupy Wall Street. And the only banner that we made in this space was Deoccupy. The only banner. The rest was from our movements. The second thing is, when we were offered in Jaskier, and you know this, and you can, I mean, when we were offered a space in Tribeca, Tribeca isn't really Tribeca, right? It's Chinatown, right? So here's gentrification, right? And then it's a gallery about this size, two floors. Rent is how much every month?
$18,000.
They want
all the lines of New York City run through that. AAC, like all the
right?
lines.
So they
connects all the boroughs.
So they gave us this opportunity, and they're just like, we want an exhibition. Told them we're not going to take this money, and this space and put up an exhibition, but we're going to make it a movement commons. And we said, how can we decenter whiteness in our spaces, and how can we make sure we open up the space and the right people come in? I mean, these are the questions you have to ask yourself. And we said, five strands of struggle. Indigenous sovereignty and struggle, Black liberation, right? These are two things that is about the United States. But then Free Palestine, why? Because it's a litmus test to New York City. Right? It's hard to swallow and it's hard to commodify Palestine, right? And then we said degentrification. Why? Because the space itself is on that land. So we started talking to Chinatown Art Brigade and started talking to CAV, organizations on the ground that are working with tenants there. And then the final thing is we said global wage workers. Why? Because we're thinking first about debt, but then we're thinking about workers. And we're thinking third about actually anti-capitalism, but without using that language, right? Those were our five strands, and we assumed dismantle patriarchy later to find out you need to spell it out.
Always dismantle patriarchy.
Right. So we started with that. Now, what does that mean? It means actually doing the work. So when we went to Brooklyn and we went to the Brooklyn Museum, we went to Brooklyn Anti-Gentrification Network. We went to their homes. We sent emails. They didn't respond. We went to their homes. We built trust. We spoke to Jaskieran. We were like, Jaskieran, we're going into this space. How do we actually recognize that the land? We were learning, right? I wasn't raised here, so I don't know what racism was in this context. I had to learn. Right? And I think that that's the work that we have to do. But through organizing, we did that work and we built that trust. So what people see are actions at museums, but what we're really doing are reclaiming spaces temporarily in a space that's anti-capitalist, that can change relationships, that can be visionary in the moment and can build trust while butting heads against power. Because you always have to be transgressive. If you're not trans, and this, so I'll end here. about identity. Identity is a kind of political, I mean, solidarity, and this comes from like Robin Kelly, but solidarity is a kind of political identity. It's not meant to be comfortable. It is about alliances and about ways of understanding collective liberation, for me. The other thing I want to say is that it is about accomplices, and sometimes we talk about warriors, right? This doesn't mean that definition is good for you, but I'm tired of being in white spaces. I'm tired of having to explain how this shit is killing you too. And I'm tired of hearing you're an ally, right? Fine, great, do the work. But I don't need, you don't need to be in my shit right now, right? Because I know my life depends on it, right? And you need to figure that part out on yourself. That doesn't mean that we're not all working in certain ways, but we're on different trajectories.
Thanks for bringing up accompliship, not allyship. I'm not that interested in allies. An ally is going to be someone who wants me to recognize what they're doing as if I'm not literally just trying to live. An ally is someone who is going to understand me as long as it's comfortable for them. And when it becomes uncomfortable, they're going to step out of the space because they have the privilege to do that. An ally is someone who is going to ask me an endless stream of stupid questions as if they can't look this up, as if I'm not like, here are books. An ally is just going to take a lot of energy away from me that I need so that my people can live, so that I can live, so that the people who I love and care about can live, so that people I don't know can live because they struggle and no one deserves to struggle. An ally is going to get in my way. And at the end of the day, when I'm standing there and I'm on a front line, an ally is going to stand by me and I'm not going to know when they're going to bounce and when they're going to stay. I'm not interested in that. I don't want to know that you're only going to fight until you stop being comfortable and then you're going to leave. I don't want to know that you're going to go a little bit out of your comfort zone because this is what allyship looks like, right? And then you're going to leave. I want an accomplice. I want someone who is putting their hearts and minds into it because they know that it's right. Because above all else, I know that this is their ethical duty because it's my ethical duty. Because that's how I live. This is not a thing that I put on a shelf when I'm done. This is a thing that I wake up to every day and I go to sleep to every night. And the only person I want next to me on these lines is someone who believes that. And if you're not at that space, maybe you're on a different trajectory. If you are like, you know, I'm pretty comfy, I have some comfy financials, like go and buy native products. Because you know what, we still need to live. We're still under a capitalist society. We still have very limited resources. And we are still preserving our culture through our art. Maybe you have a space in Philadelphia and you heard that Indigenous 215 doesn't have a space. And you're like, you know, I could give up that space forever. Get at me with that after this panel, because I'll take it. I will take it. Maybe you have garden space and you are like, you know, I haven't really used this lot at all, but I bet that there are some Lenape folks who could grow some badass shit in this area that is local to this area, that is indigenous to this space, just like they are indigenous to this space. And I bet that having land would feel really, really important to them. Cool. Give them that land back. That's great allyship. But when you're actually ready to fight with us, to fight alongside of us, when you understand that the annihilation of all of your comfort is what will bring about my freedom, get at me then too. Because maybe then you're going to be on that accompliship level. Maybe then you're ready to throw down in a way that makes you really uncomfortable, and not only makes you uncomfortable, but is going to risk your life. Not just your comfort, not just your, I have a lot of comforts that I live with, but not enough to make this analogy go farther, so I'm going to stop it. When you're ready to throw down and risk everything that you have to make sure that I can be free, that's when you have reached an accomplished level. That's when I'm ready to throw down with you, because I know that nothing is more important than the freedom of people. And I know that you know that nothing is more important than the freedom of people. And we know that the only way that we are going to get free is to struggle together, is to become not only uncomfortable, but martyrs for the situation. When we are willing to give our lives, not because we want to see freedom in our lifetime, but because we know that's the only way to continue this struggle and that's the only way to continue liberation, when you're on that level, then we could be accomplices and you can come get at me. Until then, still give us your money and give us your spaces. Give us your land. Don't make a mistake. We're still after that. We're just going to get it on our own and you're going to stand in the way, or we're going to get it on our own and you're going to get out of the way, or we're going to get it on our own and you're going to stand behind us. Y'all can choose.
Thank you all so much for staying here in the space with us, for staying extra. Thank you to Amin, Natasha, Mark, Felicia. Thank you guys for giving us your time. I want to thank you for being here. Join us for a glass of wine, a slice of pizza, and some great discussion. Thank you all.